Hello, listeners, and welcome to Fighting Failure. Today, we have a very special guest on the podcast who has come to talk to us about degrowth. Would you like to introduce yourself?
Hi there, I'm Dexter. I'm a friend of Oscar's from school. And yeah, I'm really excited to be here today.
Great. So, as I mentioned, the topic of this episode is going to be about degrowth. Personally, I've heard about it, but I don't really know a lot about the topic. Dexter here is an expert, so I think what I'd like to do is sort of you guide me through the topic and then we can sort of have a bit of deeper discussion about the points. You brought some points to talk about, so would you like to just start us off with your first point?
Sure. Well, first of all, I'd say I'm hardly an expert, but it is something that I'm quite passionate about, and I've done quite a bit of reading into it, and I think it's something that's really important to spread in order to challenge and add to the existing narratives surrounding the climate crisis, specifically that of eco-modernism. This is the typical idea that's floated around, the typical philosophical train of thought when it comes to how we fight the climate crisis. And it's the thought process that we can solve all our issues regarding the climate crisis and how we as a human society interact with nature through increasing the strength and quality of technology through innovation, purely through renewables alone. And degrowth is a movement which has really been set up to challenge that concept, to challenge the idea that man is separate from nature and can use tools to continue to dominate it. It's really a philosophy of coexisting and working in balance. So that's the main philosophical difference to keep in mind as we go out.
Yeah, so this idea of eco-modernism that you brought up is something we don't necessarily want to strive towards. It's definitely what gets thrown around a lot in terms of, because it keeps the people that are in power in the market, it keeps them in power through expanding into different areas. So if you think about a lot of big oil companies looking to transition to staying as the main energy companies, but transitioning their business towards renewables, we've seen a few examples of that. And if you look behind you on the bookshelf there, how to spend $1 trillion, that's an example probably of eco-modernism, the idea that if we have enough money, we can just use technology and use our, you know, scientific might to create solutions to the climate crisis. Would you say that's correct?
Yeah, definitely. I think that one of the main reasons why it's such a common train of thought, and it's the one that has really dominated discussions surrounding the climate crisis for so long, is because it fits so well with the current neoliberal narratives and mindset for facing the world. Neoliberal being the trust in the free market, privatization, free trade, capitalism at its finest, essentially. A lot of the ideas here really came into prominence in the early 2010s. So in 2012, for example, green growth, which is the dominant idea floating around the zeitgeist, was really pushed forward by a wide variety of international organizations, the World Bank, the OECD, the UN Environmental Program, all producing reports ensuring that the climate and ecological emergency could be solved through investing in green technology and increasing productivity. And it's a really elegant solution for the climate crisis if we look at it only through the economic and political ideas that we currently work with as a society. For one thing, we've got an economic concept called the environmental Kuznets curve. Have you heard of that?
I've heard of it. I've definitely heard of it, but I'm not really familiar with it and I couldn't tell you what it is if you asked me. It's just, you know, rings a bell. And perhaps you could explain that for the listeners as well.
Sure. So the Kuznets curve, the original one, was developed by a really famous economist called Simon Kuznets, who was studying inequality in the post-war era. Essentially, his big idea was that as the economy grows, market forces initially increase inequality, but then reduce it due to the movement from rural areas to towns. And he argued quite strongly for this. He was also the creator of GDP, which is something, a big idea, which we'll get back to. the curve itself looks like an upside down U. So yeah, as like I said, as inequality rises, so does growth, and then it drops. This has been developed to make a statement about the environment as well. So the idea is that as we grow, the economy, the carbon emissions and environmental stress that we as a society create will increase for a short while and then decrease once we hit a sort of critical mass. However, there's increasing skepticism about this concept and a lot of the other ideas being thrown around about green growth. For example, the initial Kuznets curve has largely been proven wrong by leading economists, specifically because it was using anomalous data from the post-war era. In this period, due to two things, the Great Depression of the 1930s and World War II, inequality dropped hugely because there was basically just a flattening. The rich were no longer being able to extract as many resources, grow their wealth for this period of time. And so it looked like inequality was falling as the economy grew. However, as soon as we got past that, after Kuznets published his research, the flaws in his data started to show. The same really goes for the environmental Kuznets curve. The issue here is, again, anomalous data. The economist McAfee, I can't remember his first name. I think it's probably George, to be honest. He published a study arguing that what we're seeing is definitely the environmental Kuznets curve. In the richest nations in the world, carbon emissions are dropping relative to growth. This is just a trick of the numbers. Can you guess why?
Yeah, so I'm guessing that as countries become richer, they just export their carbon emissions to poorer countries. For example, manufacturing is relocating from first world countries like the US and the UK and largely Europe as well to countries like China, Taiwan, Indonesia. And that means that although emissions are decreasing in developed countries, in low-income countries, they're actually increasing because there isn't actually, globally, there isn't a decrease in the amount of carbon emissions created by the products we consume. It's only within the countries that the carbon emissions are decreasing. Have I guessed correctly?
Yep, you've got it exactly right. And the magic of this report is that as the emissions decrease in the global north, what we previously referred to as developed nations, they increase in the global south, seemingly fitting the logic. It's fantastic. But wait, like I said, it's a trick of the numbers. Another issue is that despite the reports published by the World Bank, OECD and UN Environmental Programme in 2012, ensuring us that green growth was a viable option, computer models by researchers since, including in 2012, have consistently failed to display any scenarios where emissions and material use don't rise with growth. In other words, there is no way for us to decouple, i.e. stop the two being linked, growth and environmental degradation and emissions. Even in the best case scenarios where heavy carbon taxes are introduced and technological change and innovation massively introduces the efficiency of the economy, we'd still overshoot the planet's boundaries by significant margins were we to continue growing the economy. The final point I'd like to make about the issues with green growth is that many of the models used by leading organizations make use of faulty technologies that don't even exist yet and may never, like carbon capture.
Yeah, so this is something that I've definitely heard a lot about. A lot of what you're saying is new to me, but this use of promise technologies as a way to sort of make promises now, I think this is something that Australia is quite guilty of in terms of their carbon goals, is they're saying, we're going to be net zero by 2050, but it's almost entirely reliant on carbon capture and storage. And I guess a lot of these models that you're talking about will use future technology. They'll say, in 20 years, we will have carbon capture and storage, and that will mean that we'll be able to reduce our emissions, rather than using technology that's available now to be able to promise, you know, decreasing emissions. And something else about like this promise of green growth is that So you imagine like the amount that we're producing grows every year, and that's growth. And I guess in terms of GDP, if you produce more things, the GDP will go up. Generally, it's probably exceptions. But then you also have like a different curve of how green things are getting and how much emissions is produced per item, and that's going down. So if you, if the number of things you're producing is going up, you have to decrease the emissions per product more sharply than if the amount of things that you're producing is, say, going down, because then there's less pressure on technological advancements because you are reducing the amount of stuff that's produced. Do you get what I'm saying?
Yeah. So Jason Hickel, basically the badass of this subject, is a great economist. I highly recommend his book, Less is More, How Degrowth Can Save the World. And I'll have some further book recommendations throughout this podcast. He says that there are two main reasons why, and you've touched on some of them, why growth doesn't work here. It's because it's reliant on energy and material consumption. When the economy increases in size, we just need so much more to do it. We need so much more energy. And this is going to be an increasing problem if we're trying to convert the world economy to renewables, given that it's projected to double in size by the time we get to 2050. Not only do we need to accomplish the mammoth task of changing all the world's infrastructure to a green alternative, but we're going to have to do that twice over if we continue to grow. The second issue is that productivity increases don't cause us to produce less stuff. Because we're in an economy based on growth, productivity increases just allow us to produce the same amount of stuff with less input, which means that we end up making more. We don't reduce the amount of stuff we're making. We just make more because that's what's going to drive up the profit margins. That's what's going to make bank.
But also, to what extent is productivity actually increasing? Because I read somewhere, and you can perhaps assess the veracity of this, that most of the perceived increase in productivity in the recent sort of century is less because people are actually becoming more productive, and more because there are more women joining the workforce who are previously working unpaid, which isn't measured by GDP. Is that true as well?
Well, I'd have to look into it. Yes, I have heard things along these lines. I can't comment exactly on the validity of these claims, but I think there is most likely a lot of truth to that.
Excellent. Okay, so we were talking about GDP a lot, and in terms of you were saying like a economy focused on growth, maybe does that lead into your next point, perhaps?
So this is where, after we've outlined the problems with the eco-modernist worldview, that it's not going to work to help us save the climate crisis. And I hope I've made that point fairly well. This is where the real philosophical and political and economic challenge comes in, to think about how exactly we can rework global systems so that everyone continues to have a high standard of living, but we stay within the planet's boundaries. This is where degrowth comes in. Again, this is from Jason Hickel. Please go check out his work. He's got a fantastic blog. Degrowth is the planned downscaling of energy and resources and resource use to bring the economy back into balance with the living world. This isn't the rejection of growth absolutely, but the rejection of the adherence to growth for growth's sake. So he's still arguing that we should look to grow, but we should only look to grow in the places that need it. For example, the global south. They can still grow. Impoverished nations still definitely need to grow so that they can reach that standard of living. But for the richer nations of the world, who are consuming tons more than they need, and disproportionately affecting the amount of carbon that we shove into our atmosphere, we need to scale down, and we need to start looking for solutions soon to stop this luxury usage.
Yeah, so I guess I like this definition, because initially, perhaps maybe not personally, but a lot of the rejections you could hear of degrowth immediately would be like, oh, but we have a high standard of living, we don't want to give that up. Or, oh, what about, you know, poorer nations, they still need to grow. Are we going to deny that to them just for climate's sake? That's a lot of rejections you get for many sort of, you know, ecological arguments for certain technologies, you know, stopping fossil fuel usage, you know, we got to grow up with fossil fuels, why can't they? And so I like this definition, because what you're saying is it's not about not growing at all, but it's about focusing on how do you quantify growth and what sort of growth are you looking for? So we're looking for growth in terms of standard of living, perhaps, rather than just growth in this hard term of GDP. And I like what you said, growth for growth's sake. Like, what is the point of growth? If we look at it as a means to an end, the end is we want everyone, we want lower inequality, we want everyone to have a high standard of living, and we want the environment to, we want to stay within the planet's boundaries. That makes a lot more sense than just growing because we need to keep growing, otherwise the economy doesn't work or the economy stagnates, and that's a huge issue. So yeah, I like that point. That's very interesting.
Yeah, Hickel refers to growth as a measure for how well capitalism is working, not a measure for how well people are benefiting, you know, are being benefited by the economy and by politics. He even goes so far as to refer to the fact that we see it as a measure of welfare, as an outstanding ideological coup. That's quite an extreme, radical way of putting it, but I have to say I wholeheartedly agree with him. Where did growth come from? Why this obsession with GDP? Well, for one thing, growth is how capitalism has always run. But GDP itself originated, like I said, with Simon Kuznets back in the just before World War II, really. He developed something called gross national income, which was a precursor to it, largely to enable the US economy and the economies all around the world to get out of the Great Depression and then to maximize their resources in World War II. Because when you're in a scenario like this, in World War II, the amount of stuff that you produce, the amount of weapons you produce to keep the economy rolling while you're at war, is of paramount importance. And yet, after the war ended, we didn't move back. We kept going. And Kuznets himself disagrees with that. He never said that growth should, that GDP should be the only measure we use for all time. He was just focusing on this one period. And so I think it's a really ridiculous thing that's happened for us to be in a place where we haven't heeded this creator's advice, which is quite good, and are still focused on this number instead of people. So I guess this comes to the point where we start talking about immediate solutions for how to scale down. Do you have any ideas?
Well, so basically what you're saying is that rather than focusing on GDP as this singular measure, and even the creative GDP disagreed that rather we should be scaling down the economy, as you say, and focusing instead on the things that matter to us as a society and what we really want to improve rather than growth for growth's sake. So immediate ideas for how we could descale the economy. I imagine the first thing we need to do is just view it in a different way, because if it'd be difficult to descale the economy if it just looked like we were in a massive recession and had no plans of getting out of it. So I could imagine the first thing that we'd need is a sort of a change in how we look at the economy and how we quantify these sorts of things.
Yeah, and that's exactly what the economist Kate Raworth has done. She's another fantastic writer. She wrote Donut Economics. She's based here in Oxford. And her goal with this book, another thing that I highly recommend you read, it's fantastic, is to reframe the ways that we think about economics in a way which allows the world to, allows human society to coexist with the world in a state of balance. And she created something called the economic donut, which is this great visual aid showing you in the center all the different areas which humans need to fulfill in order to survive and thrive. So food, water, shelter, as well as things to do with social justice. So gender equality, racial inequality, etc. And we need a certain amount of resources to get there. However, on the other side, and this is what makes it a kind of donut shape, it's two rings consecutively, is the planetary boundaries, carbon emissions, ocean acidification, soil erosion, these things which if we overshoot, we're in big trouble. And so it's providing us with an alternative measure and way of looking at the world, which isn't reliant on GDP, it's people first, and it's really easy to understand. and they've started employing this in cities in Amsterdam. She's working quite closely with them. I'm not sure what stage they've got to by this point, but Amsterdam's at the head of the curve using this. There are other alternative indexes. Let me just get them up. We've got something called the Social Progress Indicator and the Genuine Progress Indicator. Both take into account various additional factors, somewhat like the donut, but they compress it into a single number. I personally prefer the donut. It shows you the exact areas we need to improve. But for the sake of single numbers, these are also pretty good.
Yeah, I would agree with you about the donut being better, because one of the issues I find with GDP is that it is just one number and it doesn't give you, there's so much information you can learn about an economy and there's so many different factors, and GDP only gives you one number. For example, GDP per capita tells you the GDP per person. So you could have like a massive GDP like China's, but actually per capita it's quite small. And that's just one example out of so many of how GDP is such a small proportion of the economy, whereas I like the donut showing you much more information.
Yeah, and even GDP obscures things. GDP per capita obscures things. It shows you the mean income. And so it shows you the average, but it doesn't show the spread of that income throughout a society. It masks inequalities. It also hides stuff within the hidden economy. So stuff that goes on in the black market. It hides stuff to do with housework, stuff that goes unpaid. Really, really, really crucially important labor that we do, that's ignored and largely treated as worthless. And so there's debates within feminism as well about how can we really fix this and rework this so that it helps anyone living and doing lots of housework. Another example of the problems with GDP and what it masks is it provides massive incentives for atomizing goods and services, which is something crucial that we're going to get onto as I start to talk about immediate things we can change that are more to do with regulation, and then I'll go on to talk about structural changes that need to be made and my own beliefs in terms of them. So one example of what GDP does is it's obviously far better for GDP for everybody to have a car, and it's far worse for GDP for 100 people to take a single bus. That's not great for the climate. In certain circumstances, it's not great for people either. You probably know more about the specific details of public transport. You've done several episodes on it, I understand. Yeah, so do you want to comment on that?
Yeah, this is the issue, because one of the great things about public transport, especially when it's well implemented, is it's more convenient for people. And so it, and in terms of road usage as well, public transport is just so much better in so many ways, because it can cost a lot less. This is one of the reasons we don't have a car, is it's just very expensive to maintain a car, because you have to spend money on your MOT and your, you know, that's like an annual or biannual servicing you have to get for your car. You have to pay for car insurance. And you can imagine every time there's a transaction that's recorded on GDP. But in terms of just, is this society good to live in? The more cars there are, arguably the worse it is, because more cars on the road, we talked about this tons in previous episodes in the urban expansion segment. It just, it's not really a very nice place to live. Whereas taking public transport is much more convenient for most people if it's well implemented. Because I think a lot of people would actually prefer to take a train. Like, this is quite evident in London, for example, where the underground is quite widespread, because you can do stuff on the train and you can get some work done, or you can just scroll Instagram, but you're not stuck in traffic the whole time, even if there is a delay, for example. But you can imagine that because it's cheaper, something cheaper, you might only pay, you know, a pound for a journey, or there could even be a free bus. That's not recorded in the same way on GDP, despite the fact that it's providing the same service to society.
Yeah. So I'm just going to go through a list of further things. I'm going to go into the immediate solutions. Number one is end planned obsolescence. This is the practice of purposely producing goods that wear down or break very quickly. And companies like Apple are notorious for this because it increases profit margins. If they can sell you one good that will break within 2 or 3 years, as opposed to a good which will last you, an iPhone which will last you about 10 years, then you're going to go back and buy something new. And that's a massive issue, because it's a huge resource drain on the economy. It produces far more emissions than we need to. and it only serves to maximize profits and make investors happy. A note on that is that 13 billion smartphones were produced in the last decade. Take a guess at how many are still in use.
Within the last decade, so you could imagine that around, if we imagine an equal distribution among the years, around, I could say, 3 billion still in use?
Booyah, you got it exactly. Yeah, that seems crazy to me. Yes, sure, tech's moved on, but it doesn't have to be like this. And this moves me on to my next point, maximize the circular economy. So this is basically reducing the amount we use by enabling people to reuse items and repair them instead of buying an entirely new smartphone, for example. So there are calls to make products modular, interchangeable, and repairable so that you can... so that you don't have to buy a completely new smartphone whenever your charging port blows, which is one of the most common issues I've experienced. I've got no idea how to change it. And Apple, for example, I'm continuing to come back to them because, like I said, they're really notorious. They make it extremely difficult for you to change it on your own. So you either have to go to an official Apple store to get it done, or you have to buy a new phone, both of which are great for them, less great for us. Companies like Fairphone already do this. They've got an entirely modular phone. They've made great strides to create a product which is decent for the environment, doesn't put that much strain on it, and follows great guidelines of social justice. But there's still a long way to go, and Fairphone still isn't really that mass market. An idea floating around is that governments could introduce a right to repair with any product sold, as well as extend warranties. So you have to guarantee that it will last this long for this product, and you have to guarantee that people will be able to change around your products. There's also some discussion, which I'm not going to go into in such detail, about changing laws around patents, so that people can have more freedom with reworking and repairing their property. And you've also talked about recycling in the past. Do you have any points about that as well?
Yeah, I want to cotton on to quite a few of the points. First of all, with planned obsolescence, I would say with regards to Apple, that definitely not good, objectively good. There's a long way they can go, especially in terms of how proprietary they are with their repairing. And that's coming along. They've now released some sort of limited amount of self-repairability with the new iPhones that you can order spare parts and have them done by a third party. It's definitely a long way to go. But if you look at the strict emissions of their products, Apple is way ahead of all the other competitors in the market, which means that basically no one is there yet. Fairphone is definitely good, but you know, I've watched a few videos about them, and they admit by their own admission that even they cannot be perfect yet, because it, and obviously their products are way more expensive because it's such a small company. And another example of planned obsolescence, perhaps a classic one, is light bulbs. Now, there's that one light bulb in a fire station somewhere that's been going for 100 years. And nowadays, even like modern light bulbs, don't even work the advertised number of hours. And that's difficult because modern light bulbs can't be thrown away as easily as previous ones, because incandescent, it's just like a tungsten filament, which is quite easy to throw away because it's metal, you can boil it down or whatever. Whereas modern ones made with LEDs specifically have a semiconductor layer, which is how they make lights, which is, it's type of e-waste, basically. It's much harder to dispose of. But yeah, the light bulb conspiracy is a great video by Veritasium that explains the issues with this. It's a classic perverse incentive, basically, is that the incentive of the company, and this goes against perhaps, you know, the founding principles of free market economics, whatever, the principle of the company, the way they want to make money, is at odds with the product that the consumer wants. And that's not a good thing. And so planned obsolescence is obviously a terrible thing, and it's, you know, companies are just trying to maximize their profits instead of actually making a good product. And I don't think anyone's happy with that. But what's amazing when you think about smartphones is that nowadays people don't really expect a smartphone to last that long. You ask how long should you keep a smartphone? Some people might say 3 years-ish. And when you think about how long products used to last, that's actually a ridiculously short amount of time. And considering how much the products cost and how long they should last, like, most Android phones won't last more than 3 years because you won't get updates after that. Apple is better because they'll give you updates for 5, 6, 7 years on your devices. My parents only like a year or two ago got rid of their iPhone 4s because because Apple provides fairly regular updates. But why shouldn't a phone last for 10 or 20 years? It's with such complex engineering in it. There aren't really that many physical reasons why it shouldn't. It's just more about trying to get people onto the next product and the next product to sustain this upwards growth forevermore. And so the idea of like the circular economy and the right to repair is a great way to fix this sort of stuff. But it also needs some sort of structural change, because otherwise it's basically the government is trying to fight the companies in an attempt to sort of rein them in. And that's difficult to do. But you mentioned patent reform, and this is something that's really interesting. Patents and copyrights, the two sort of separate areas, because a patent, and then there's also trade secrets. So a trade secret is something like the Coca-Cola formula. And the thing is, because Coca-Cola have never patented their formula, it means that you could create a cola drink with exactly the same recipe and you couldn't really get sued for it. You couldn't use the same branding because that's under different laws. Whereas a patent, you make it public, and because you made it public, it is protected. No one else can use the same patent, but you only have 20 years to use it after that. So Lego's patent, for example, is expired. Anyone can make, micro bricks or whatever. And no one...
Mega blocks.
And Lego can't sue them for it. Obviously, something like Lego, you can't really make a trade secret, but the Coca-Cola formula is a good example of a trade secret. Copyrights, obviously, is a different beast, and I think we should reduce copyright as well, but that's more artistic rather than physical products. But I think the thing to do with patents, and this is thanks to a video by Polymatter, the thing to do with patents is rather than giving people exclusive rights to their invention for 20 years, there should instead be some sort of reward system for inventing new things. So there'd obviously need to be a way to assess, is this just like a dumb invention, like, oh, we invented a stick for a dog. Is this actually a useful invention? But there should be some sort of reward. That way there is still, because in many ways, patents just act as an incentive. So if there's a reward, people have an incentive to create these new things and to invent new things, and they get that reward. But it also means that you can immediately introduce that element of competition to make better products rather than the stagnation that comes in 20 years. It's especially an issue, I think, with pharmaceutical companies and having patents over that sort of thing. Can just, they've spent so much money on R&D, and that's why they need a patent, in order to reap the reward from that. So if we just reward them for the R&D that they've put in, and so they get the same amount of money back in a sense, but they don't have an exclusive right to it for 20 years.
You've made some fantastic points there, and I agree with pretty much all of them, though I'd like to get into some nuances about exactly how we handle patents a bit later on, somewhat indirectly. But yeah, the main point that I think is really important that you touched on is that a lot of these smaller changes can't be fully implemented without broader structural change. And I will get to leading ideas and my own ideas about how we can achieve that structural change just after I finish these final few smaller points. Your point about how we've come to accept smartphones lasting a couple years, or trading up your smartphone every single year in a fairly ineffective way for resource use, is a really great one that leads on to the point of reducing advertising. This could be another great example of Hickel's extraordinary ideological coup. And he argues that we should either cut out advertising entirely or put strict limits on where and when and how much it can be done. The vast majority of advertising today is to manufacture wants in people through psychological tricks and conditioning, not necessarily to, well, not at all, to just inform you about a product so that you, as the rational economic man, can make the perfect decision. No, we no longer have the incredibly long, fast, shouty people on our TVs telling us about all the things that this brand new motor car can do. It's about the emotions that we feel from it. It's about these psychological tricks making you feel good when you see the new Ford driving past with happy families in it. And so by banning or limiting it, we can reduce the resource drain that the industry presents, because it's a multi-billion dollar pound industry that, like I said, resource use, we don't need it. And it induces so much unnecessary consumption because of it.
Yeah, I really love this because something that I ponder a lot philosophically about, whatever, you know, when I'm cycling down the Cowley Road, which I don't do very often. That was a bad example of a road. Cycling down the high street, you know, going past these beautiful old colleges, thinking, like, I need to think about philosophy. The thing I think about a lot is, you know, if you and now I've lost my train of thought.
I believe in you, Oscar. Come on.
Okay, so let's think about it. So the thing you're talking about is this induction of want. I don't think that's not the right noun, is it? But inducing want and making people want things. And this is the thing, right, is that if, you know, my sister is, you know, out with her friends and she has, or no, a better example, she's, no, my grandma's come over from Australia and she's gone out with grandma and to the shops and whatever, and oh, and they got a milkshake. And that's like, and if I didn't know that happened, like, I wouldn't care. I didn't actually want a milkshake that day. But then if she comes home and she's like, guess what, Oscar? Grandma got me a milkshake. And then suddenly I really want a milkshake. And so it's this idea that you don't actually want something until someone makes you want it. I haven't really explained that very well, but the more philosophical thing is like, what you don't know can't hurt you. And that's not necessarily true in every way. But in a lot of ways is that if I don't know that my sister has gone out and gotten an amazing treat without me, then that doesn't really matter to me. And or even if she like stole one of my sweets from my cupboard, if I don't know it's not there, I'm not really hurt by that. And so this is the same thing with advertising. They're making you want something. They're giving you this pain so that you can have this unnecessary consumption.
Yeah, I think a good point you could have added to that analogy is that you already know that milkshakes exist. You don't need someone to tell you that milkshakes exist. If you developed a craving all on your own for milkshakes, sure, by all means, go for it. But this has been induced in you from what someone else has done. Taste the feeling, something along those lines. Final point. This takes us into the more radical end of the smaller points, and then we get into the really radical juicy stuff, which I'm so excited for, is to reduce the work week. This is a big one. People all over the world have been talking about this, making a 4-day work week instead of a 5-day work week because it increases productivity. Well, we know the issues with productivity. Why does Hickle say that we should reduce the work week? It's because this will decrease greatly the amount that we need to produce as well as the amount that we need to consume. Okay, if we reduce the work week as well as the pay, for example, I think I've lost my train of thought here and how exactly I'm going to illustrate it. Then not only are we producing less within the economy, but people are consuming less because of it. And obviously this needs to be accompanied by subsequent changes so that this drop in pay can work and we will get into them. But it would provide people with a lot more time on their hands to do the things that really make life worth living. I'll be getting into what really excites me about degrowth, and that's happiness and the focus it has on human happiness in a sec. But a couple examples of how reducing the work week could help, aside from just decreasing the amount that we're forced to produce and consume, because if you've got money, you're going to spend it. People who work longer hours make up for it by consuming far more. They rely on high-speed travel, meal deliveries, impulsive purchases, retail therapy, so just buying stuff so that you feel good and make your stresses go away, far more than the average person. And this is only a couple examples. People make up for the amount that they're working and the amount that they do in life that they don't enjoy by having these like blips of enjoyment from stuff that they're buying. What was the next point? Sorry about this. Also, to borrow a term from the anthropologist, late anthropologist David Graeber, another total badass, having a bullshit job, a job which doesn't mean much, okay, just sitting at a desk, typing, making it, working as a secretary, just moving money around, doing something which doesn't really need to be done, but it's just there to make someone higher up in the ranks look good, or just because you need to be employed somewhere, or just in any capacity where the work isn't meaningful, doesn't count for much. Having that kind of job is hugely psychologically damaging to people. And so we should focus on developing more meaningful work instead. We can reduce the prominence of some sectors of the economy while growing others tactically dependent on our needs and benefit everyone as a whole. And I'm going to illustrate this point far better when we get on to talking about happiness.
Yeah, this sounds really interesting. I don't think I really have much to add. So let's move on to your next point.
Okay, so moving straight on to happiness. This is what really excites me about degrowth. It moves us away from focusing on GDP and numbers and focusing on people. Because GDP doesn't causally increase welfare. Largely, whether or not people are happy depends on additional factors and where the money is distributed in the economy. GDP can be a rough indicator of how an economy is doing, but it can equally show nothing at all. For example, the people in countries with a lower GDP per capita, even nearing just $10,000 a year in income, with robust social services, health and education systems, and ample time to form strong bonds with friends, are significantly happier on average than those in the richest countries in the world. A lot of the evidence from psychologists studying happiness has a lot of proof regarding the old axiom, money can't buy you happiness, money can't buy you love, etc. It shows that material gains cause minor increases in happiness over time. So you'll get a short blip of happiness if you buy that new speaker, you buy that new computer. And then slowly the appreciation and enjoyment you get from it decreases until you get back to square one, your kind of happiness baseline. What can permanently increase this happiness baseline is spending time with friends, having meaningful work, art, etc. All the things which give you a fruitful, flourishing life. And that's something that GDP misses out on. Tons, loads. So by moving the goal towards happiness, reducing the amount of work that we have to do, reducing the amount of reliance that we have on stuff and the anxieties that we have about conspicuous consumption, making sure that we have the right stuff, could do a lot of good for people the world over. So sure, it may look like austerity, it may look like we're cutting back on the money we're spending and what the progress that the world is making. But I don't see it that way. I think that it's making a rational choice about how humans live best and how we can live best alongside the planet. And sure, growth can have great benefits for people. You need to get to a point where all basic needs are met, at least. But once you get to that, we can start expanding and questioning how much we need certain things.
Yeah, I really like this framework. And what you were saying about material items, I can definitely relate to personally. As you know, when you first get your new phone, you're like, oh my God, this is so cool. It does so much cool stuff. You know, might pick up on that reference, you might not. And then you know, you get used to it and it gradually brings you lessons, happiness, and just becomes an accepted part of your life. But I think this also relates back to the stuff you're talking about inducing want, is that we become happy when we get a new product, probably because it's been something we really wanted and we're looking at, or say, you know, look at the iPhone 13, the newest iPhone, that looks so cool, I want it, you know, it's cool. And then if you get it, that will give you happiness. But if we think like 50 years into the future, what's the latest product going to look like then? We really have no idea. And it's that thing that we're not even really wanting that thing because we don't know that it exists. And, you know, I spent many years of my life living in the global south, and specifically Malawi and Sri Lanka. And when we look at the villages out there, those people are so poor and they have barely anything to live by. But they're still laughing so much. They feel so happy in there. They're playing with this football that's just made out of plastic bags melted together. And happiness doesn't have to be because of the material items that we have. And having material items only brings a temporary amount of happiness. And this is something that I've seen elsewhere on the internet as well about what you should do with your money, is that rather than buying material items, like, yes, buy a few things, but it doesn't bring you that far. What really brings you happiness is spending experiences with friends. And you can still spend money, but if you spend money on experiences with friends, that brings you so much more happiness, even in the long term, even once the experience is finished, that will bring you more happiness in the long term. So I agree, the happiness framework is a much better way to look at things.
Yeah, stress is also a major one. That's kind of the opposite of happiness in this case. And focusing on growth, focusing on the grind, focusing on making as much money as possible, obviously reduces from that as well. One example of a country which has done fantastically, despite being relatively poor, is Costa Rica. I might be wrong, if so, correct me. But no, they don't have a military. They abolished their military after World War II so that they could spend far more on education and health. They provide free education and health for everybody. They've got a population of about 4 million, I think. You may want to fact check that.
Yeah, keep talking.
Cool, will do. And the average income there, I believe, is about $10,000 a year. I've lost my notes on this. I'm running on what I had. 5 million people. Okay, well, it's grown. But yeah, Costa Rica. These consistently top the social progress index, an index which combines happiness, living standards, and environmental coexistence, precisely because their country has focused so much on building a robust welfare state, building a system which has environmental protection codified into its constitution. You can't cut down certain areas, I believe. And crucially, their economy has not yet entered the stage where people in it are trying to engage in conspicuous consumption. They're not yet in the race for status. They're not yet trying to buy everything they want, because they don't have that much more than what they need. They're still slightly over the boundaries of the economic donut, because they still rely on fossil fuels, though they're making the change. They were one of the first countries to pledge carbon neutrality by 2021. They failed on that. They're still working on it, but they're trying to get there. The issue here, though, is that as the economy grows, there's nothing really to prevent them from making that shift yet. As the economy grows, which they're trying to do, they're trying to achieve green growth. So we'll see how that goes. That may make or break the theories I'm presenting here. But bear in mind, they're on a far smaller scale and haven't really started building up. They haven't built up their infrastructure and reliance on fossil fuels to the same extent as we have. As their economy grows, they may start to rely more on the things that detract from real human happiness. Do you have any further comments, or shall I go on to talk about inequality?
Costa Rica is an interesting example that people sort of living, they don't have so much stuff, but that doesn't mean that they can't be happy. And I like this idea that we don't, rather than, showing off by what we have, we can show off by who we are, and we can just instead like enjoy life experiences, you say. And Costa Rica seems promising, and if you look at the political news, it can be quite depressing how little politicians care about the climate crisis, and to see a country that, even if it's not perfect, and even if it might not be going in the right direction, how much it's done already to actually pledge carbon neutrality that early, even if you fail, and to codify environmental protection, to not spend much on defense. It can be difficult politically to not spend on defense because, patriotism can affect voters' attitudes, but it seems promising, and I guess we'll just have to keep an eye on how Costa Rica goes from there.
Yeah, we obviously can't apply the exact same principles that Costa Rica has to our own countries. There would be a lot of resistance to completely abolishing the military, for example. That's a debate for another day. I'm not sure where I stand on that. One final point, though, about Costa Rica is that they have pretty much a stable level of life expectancy across all incomes, which is something which we see barely anywhere else in the world. Yeah. It's got a higher life expectancy than the States, many other nations in the global north. But yeah, crucially, regardless of your income, your life expectancy is pretty much the same. Whereas in other places, we see a massive decrease for those who are extremely poor, or even just in the bottom 50, 30, 20% of people. So how are we going to manage this? How are we going to get to the point where we can safely make sure that everyone has what they need. This is where it comes to the big radical ideas. And the politics of it really get involved. A lot of the time with the climate crisis, sure, there's a debate about whether or not we should do stuff and how we and like minor discussions about how we should go around stuff within the framework of eco-modernism. But the politics is really embedded in degrowth because it sees the climate crisis as a political crisis, a political problem. And it's got a fairly, it's got a very left-wing approach to it. Degrowthists typically argue that in order to get this baseline for people, we need to reduce inequality. Just reduce it and distribute the income and wealth that the top 1% have, who produce 30 times more carbon emissions than the bottom 50%, and spread that throughout the global economy so that the global south doesn't need to grow as much, so that everybody has what they need, and so that we can exist safely within the boundaries of the earth, making sure that everybody can thrive. This is the major, this is degrowth's big focus on how we can get there. It also creates the political challenge, and I'll get onto that as my last point of the show. Maybe we can have some further questions, but the last point that I'm going to be making is a discussion about degrowth as a social movement. So how do we synthesize everything that we've just said about inequality, about making it so that the government doesn't fight businesses into a fully fledged political system which we can fight for and move for? Well, Kate Raworth, the economist I mentioned previously, argues that a key factor of the growth-based economy that we live in, which we need to focus on, other than just changing the goal, is looking at the role that finance plays in making it so that there's such a growth imperative. I bumped into her at the Oxford Station once and had a lovely conversation with her. She's so nice, about how we can reconcile some of the existing features of our global system with the need for the environment. And I asked her, because she still focuses on markets a lot in her book, I asked her how we can still use markets when they are so based on growth. Her answer I loved. She said that markets and capitalism are two separate things. Degrowth is an anti-capitalist movement, but that doesn't mean it's anti-market. She used the example of Ollie's tie on the Cali Road. Cali Road, St. Clements. Not sure which one. It's one of them. It's a local family-owned business which makes enough money to be self-sufficient, but doesn't grow more and stays within operating zones. And this is because it's financed, she argued, locally between them. So markets don't necessarily have to be based on growth, and they can can work really well to distribute things to people who want them. And it's about changing the way we look at markets so that instead of serving private individuals, they can serve the community and the planet as a whole.
Yeah, so on Sports Day, you spotted me reading a book by Ed Miliband called Go Big. And one of the solutions proposed, or at least one of the things that was talking about, was markets and how we view markets. And the thing is that markets are not intrinsically linked to capitalism. A market is just a tool that we use in order to distribute resources and in order to, because, originally bartering is very difficult. Like, I might want to buy a pillow, but what am I going to trade for? I don't want to trade an entire cow for a pillow or whatever like that. And so market is just a tool that we use. And so we should keep this in mind, as rather than making us serve the markets, we should instead make the markets serve us, because it's just a tool in order to better society rather than something that needs to be govern how society works.
Yeah, exactly. So how do we go about this? Well, I think I haven't really seen much. I need to do far more reading on the topic. about how to actually implement this idea. Raw Earth herself is focusing on, really respectably, how she can help individual firms work within the kind of donut economics framework, because she sees that from her position as a professor, she can do more working with firms and really trailblazing the way on that front than trying to instigate major social change. But my own thought processes with this and how to make markets serve the community is that we really have to tackle investment and make it so that investment is decided upon by a community. Which community? My current ideas, and you're very welcome to challenge me on this, engage in debate with me, is that we should repurpose local government so that it's so that a lot of the investment we decide happens at a local level. Participatory budgeting is one example of how this can work. It's not a direct comparison, but in Brazil, places like Porto Alegre, this system where citizens come and decide where to distribute a portion of the city's budget has been working really well to serve people there. And I believe that we can do this with markets as well, having it so that citizens in their local communities can choose where to distribute money to grow and expand the sectors that they need and the local businesses which they need and will help them more than instead of having a shady investor sitting in Wall Street acting in it only for themselves, funding the oil crisis. It's not a perfect solution. I'll be getting into some of the caveats and how we can expand on it and improve it, but I still think that it would be it's a good starting point just to think about when it comes to how we regain control as a collective.
Yeah, so this idea of bringing more power to the local level and working with communities is something else that was brought up in that same book I was talking about. And the thing is that representative democracy only goes so far. I was watching a different video about how one problem with representative democracy is that it's so fueled by money and lobbying. And you know, if you think about the US, most Congress people are like millionaires because it's money infiltrates their system. It's not corruption exactly, but lobbying is so present that most representatives aren't actually representative of the people they represent, if you get what I'm saying. But I like the idea of participating budgeting and bring more power to the local level. In the UK, there isn't actually much power afforded to local authorities. One issue that the book brought up was bus schedules or bus services, which were controlled by Westminster, even though and they were a big problem. And the thing is that no one was actually voting at the local elections because they wanted change with the buses and no one was willing to change that because the local council or the people that they're voting for just didn't have that power. So if we could have more power transferred to the people who have power to, or more power transferred to the local level for communities to make their own decisions. And I think this is within companies as well. You know, like employee-owned companies are a good example of this, is where it's, you know, participatory budgeting, as well as citizens' assemblies are two examples of introducing more direct democracy into our representative democracy and giving people, perhaps elected by lot, or lottery, a bigger say in how countries are governed. And although many people may be apathetic at first glance, a lot of people, you would be surprised at how they're willing to throw themselves into sort of local governance policies. And if you give people an actual say, they will take that responsibility. Whereas if you just give them like a choice of people at the polling station, that drives political apathy as well.
I wholeheartedly agree with you. I'm a massive fan of certain forms of direct democracy, less so referenda, more so sortitions, citizens' assembly, citizens' juries. And I think that they are, these discussions about how we can use them more effectively, maybe not entirely as massive entire replacements for the existing political structures that we have, but implementing them in as checks or giving people directly more control is at the core of so many discussions and problems that we're facing in the world today. I think that you raised an excellent point about how this can be used in firms as well. I'm not saying that we abolish firms. I think that, like I said, for the same reason that I'm kind of thinking about markets, they're less centralized. Having lots of firms means that we can distribute things easily. Markets are a semi-autonomous way of distributing things really well to those who want them. I don't like the term equilibriums, or naturally reaching equilibriums with the market, because equilibria. Thank you for taking me up on my grammar there.
I'm so pleased with the use of referenda, so.
Yep, no, that's fair enough. I am an English student. making it so that these... anyway, this is a tangential point. Moving on. Yeah, stakeholder capitalism is another kind of concept that you touched on, which has been gaining ground. And while I wouldn't agree so much with the implementation of it currently, I'd agree with the principle of getting firm owners, getting people working in the firm to have a say alongside the shareholders. I'm not so keen on shareholders as a system, as I've established. And my belief currently is that firms should operate along the same lines of sortition, the same way we have governments operating, so that we've got everyone working within a firm having a say about what goes on, so that we can reduce the exploitation and inequality that happens within them.
Yeah, I would agree. As I say, I mean, I'm not particularly well educated on this topic. That's why I wanted to bring you in, because I don't think I could have done an episode on degrowth by myself with Hisham. So it's been, I mean, yeah, bringing you on has been helpful. It's synthesized together a lot of different ideas in my mind, because I've heard of these different things, and you say something like, oh yeah, I know that. That makes sense. And you've brought it all together onto this umbrella, and that's been really useful. And now I've lost my train of thought, so continue.
Sure thing. The caveat to this, of course, though, is that people are complex, and finance isn't the only reason why we have growth, or why we're breaching the boundaries that growth can take us to safely. The people in Wall Street aren't some kind of demonic alien lizard people force. They're normal people. And they're normal people acting in their self-interest, as can anybody else. And so we still need to work out ways to make sure that specific firms, regardless of how they're organized internally, and specific governments, local governments, regardless of how they're also organized internally, are still working in some capacity with other organizations, be it a government or a firm. And to ensure that these bodies can't just act in their own self-interest, regardless of if they're acting collectively. And that's a bigger issue, which I think requires more discussion. I'm still working out where I stand on it. I'm currently toying around with ideas of caps on wealth and income. Anything above that gets, anything above a set level, let's say $20,000, that's roughly the mean income across the world, and coincidentally the amount that everyone can have without going beyond the planet's boundaries. Anything above that gets taxed away and put into the investors, i.e. local government's hands, things along these lines. But at this point, I'm just spewing hypotheticals, things, big conversations that need to be had within the degrowth movement to make it work, but still ideas which may have some merit.
Yeah, I mean, the only question with that is one of the main critiques of, you know, Marxism, which is with such a comparatively, or at least for in the global north, maybe less so in the global south, with such a comparatively low threshold for how much wealth someone can accumulate, what sort of incentive is there for people to do more high-value jobs?
Exactly. The incentive point's a big one. Hickel argues that we can just make it so that we train up more doctors so that doctors work less, they don't have the intense stress that they typically undergo. Maybe easier said than done. We're already trying to train doctors like crazy. not everyone wants to be a doctor.
Well, I think there's an unreasonably low cap on how many med students there can be. And I think so many people are getting rejected from med school, even if they probably could be a good doctor. So I think it's unfair to say that we're training as working as hard as we can to increase the number of doctors.
Yeah, so there are a fair number of fixes we can do. Does it fix the underlying issue? Maybe, maybe not. Should we even be that concerned with incentives if the goal is to reduce the incentive people have to grow no matter the cost? I think that's another important philosophical point.
Touching on the bringing it back to happiness, I feel like if people don't have a motivation to work hard, then that can be almost in a strange way draining. I feel like if I you know, really want to edit this episode and I'm working hard on it, that actually gives me more happiness than if I'm sort of like going around half-heartedly. So I think having a good incentive to do something makes people more happy to do their work.
But it's about finding stuff that's meaningful for people. You're saying that the incentive there, in this case, with the issue being income caps, is a material one. Getting people to work in order to get more income, which we've already established is fairly flawed. In terms of finding happiness, it can bring happiness, but largely it's the work itself which does, and the additional things that come from having an expanded income. So yeah, I'm happy to move on from this point. My main goal here is just to float ideas around to get people thinking in terms of degrowth, because there are so many fantastic people out there who could be having incredible ideas along these lines about how to fix things if only they got their heads out of the eco-modernist mindset. That's my goal for today. And I'd like to present ideas. Like I said at the start, I'm not an expert at these things. I'm just a 17-year-old kid trying to work out how to navigate the world and what I should believe. And I'm not there yet, but I'd love to get other people thinking. The final point I'd like to make about the evaluation of degrowth itself is about investment. There's a narrative currently among neoliberal economists, but also among many others, that technological innovation can only come from firms, can only come from private businesses competing with one another to create the greatest technology possible, and making it more efficient and making it so that it serves people more. I think that it's really important to consider the work of the final economist I'm going to mention, Mariana Mazzucato, who has demonstrated quite conclusively that the idea that we need firms to push technological change, which I'm still saying we need, degrowth isn't a rejection of technological change. This idea is a myth. To take Apple for an example, I know I keep coming back to them. They're not the perfect example, but they're the big one and everyone knows them. All the technology that Steve Jobs needed to make the iPhone, GPS, internet, etc., was created by government, by the military. Tesla, another example, had massive funds from the government. So It's about getting a mix and often just getting a load of resources into one place, which is an advantage of centralized government. You can get a load of resources together via tax to fund things. So I'm not saying that when it comes to local investment, we should purely work in terms of local investment.
Yeah, I mean, it's often argued that private companies are more efficient because they focus on profit, but you can imagine that, and this is not, I'm not saying this is what I wholeheartedly support, but you can imagine that centralization would actually make it more efficient. And this is something that actually Elon Musk companies have been quite good at, is this vertical integration, that because SpaceX creates every part of their rockets, and so does Tesla in many ways, that creates efficiency. So if you had one giant firm, like in an extreme hypothetical, one giant firm run by the government creating everything, that would be a lot more efficient than having competing private firms, you could imagine.
It's more efficient, but it's also more vulnerable to crises. Like if your massive firm breaks down, then that's it. Kaput, you're gone. But if just one part of the competing structure of smaller firms breaks down, you can still work with others and you can find replacements more easily. So I think it's about striking a balance there. The main message to put across is balance and is finding versatility in what we have. Humans are versatile. We are very complex creatures, far more complex than like the traditional idea of the rational economic man. We can be self-interested. We can also be incredibly serving to other people given the right circumstances. And so it's about finding the ways that we can maximize them to the best of our ability.
But also within a philosophical sense, my argument that, and this is basically adapted from a podcast I listened to a while back, my argument for why free will doesn't exist is that because we are centered on pleasure and we do things to give ourselves pleasure, but because of the way that our brains are wired, we very often derive pleasure from making other people feel happy as well. So if we had an economic mindset focused on happiness, you could imagine that a lot more people be willing to serve others because of this, you know, focus on giving ourselves happiness and giving other people's happiness. Rebranding it in that way could possibly make people a lot less self-serving.
Yeah, and this is where a lot of the emphasis on community comes in. Some of the stuff we've lost can be used to our advantage. This is kind of where I'd like to get into my final point for today, about how palatable degrowth is as a social movement. Obviously, in order to get these political changes through, we'd have to have a massive change in the global mindset, the common sense, if you will, of all the peoples in the UK, in the world at large. And then we'd have to finally push through change so that the ruling class has to listen. How do we get there? How good is degrowth compared to other ideologies on a pragmatic sense? I'm quite hopeful. I think that degrowth is versatile enough to unite lots of different people. It's anti-capitalist, sure. A growing number of people are anti-capitalist, looking for solutions. They just don't fully agree with the solutions that are already existing. Be they anarchism, socialism, other sorts of isms. Any others?
Eco-socialism.
That's a fun one. Yeah, another mix of socialism. Anyway, moot point. Yeah, so there's a lot of... And people still aren't entirely sold on these traditional modes of thinking and or traditional radical modes of thinking, I should say. And while degrowth, or the degrowth that I've outlined, borrows a lot of elements from these, the decentralization of parts of anarchism, the direct democracy of anarchism and socialism, the worker control of socialism, it still takes what we have from the existing system and is able to put it together really nicely. Second point in favor of degrowth as a social movement is that it is able to really work with the existing struggle to do with inequality in all its forms around the world. We had outrage and protest after the 2008 financial crash with the Occupy movement. It fizzled out, but a lot of the ill will towards finance, a huge part of degrowth, is still there. A lot of the ill will towards the top 1%, still there. Degrowth can work with this, and it can work with this with outside the Marxist framework. I'm not saying that the Marxist framework is right or wrong. I think that's irrelevant. I think it's just that degrowth, works better on a pragmatic sense. My final point, unless I can think of any others, to degrowth's benefit is that the message of it is quite simple and universal. We spend a lot of time today talking about happiness, and I think that that's something that people the world over all want to... or want to achieve naturally. Of course humans want happiness.
It is the ultimate goal that we are wired to desire. We desire pleasure, and that is innately sort of wired into our brains. So it makes sense that it would be rational for us to pursue that in the best way possible.
I'd move away from the semantics of pleasure somewhat, but at least positive mental states, and happiness plays a big role in this. I think happiness is something different. But again, philosophical points, one that we don't really have time for. We can discuss at length some other day. Catch me in the corridors at school. It's a simple message. Growth bad-ish, happiness good. And from that, we can build up. and it's just about getting that message out to people. There are some caveats, some difficulties, which I'm going to present in a sec, but do you have any further comments?
No, give me your caveats.
My caveats, okay. Caveat number one, degrowth can be branded as austerity. Of course, in a political struggle like this, there is going to be resistance. Resistance from the people who benefit from the status quo, the current political system. That's something that's already massively apparent in how the current the current climate movements have been resisted by politicians, by lobbyists, by firms. Lots of people don't want this for various reasons. Some of them are ideological reasons. Okay, perfectly good-willed people disagreeing with it because they have a different understanding of the world. And so something that degrowth is going to have to fight really hard for is building up a large number of people who are willing to, who believe in it, essentially, who are willing to really commit to it and work with its ideas and spread it very rapidly. We don't have much time. And so we're going to have to undergo a really immense, rapid ideological transformation. It's harder without the media on the side of degrowth. But like I said, it's less radical. And in comparison to the radical branches of the climate movement, I think, like I said, it's a lot more palatable. A great thinker, and another book that I'm going to highly recommend, is Andreas Malm's How to Blow Up a Pipeline. I read recently. It doesn't actually tell you how to blow up a pipeline. It tells you why you should. Not that I am, for legal reasons. But he's arguing that there are major benefits to having a radical flank in a social movement because it forces governments to compromise slightly more.
Yeah, the Overton window.
Exactly. The Overton window shifts. Do you want to explain the Overton window?
So basically, I think the best way to frame this would be in terms of Donald Trump. So traditionally, before Donald Trump, you'd have the Democratic Party and the Republican Party. We're talking about like when Democratic Party is left and Republican is right, because they used to be flipped. And then they somehow, like sometime in American history, they flipped sides of the political spectrum. That has something to do with them, their positions on, because I think Republican was initially anti-slave trade. And anyway, I won't get into that. But originally, basically, they're both huge umbrella parties trying to encompass everyone on one side of center. But Republicans traditionally would be, you know, small government, low taxes, pro-business. But then when Trump came in, he was far more radical than most Republicans had ever been. And because he was so radical, it meant that people were much more open to sort of moderate right-wing terminology. And so one thing that you saw during the reign of Trump on American television would that be on a panel, there'd be three people. There'd be a Democrat, there'd be a traditional Republican, and then there'd be a Trumpist. So actually by having someone so extreme in the presidency and in the media, it actually meant that someone who was just your average Republican actually suddenly looked a lot more reasonable than when it was just average Republican versus average Democrat.
Yeah, I think you've outlined that really well. And so here, Marm, and myself now, I guess, because I agree with him. We're calling for not just degrowthers to start movements, but Marxists, anarchists, anybody on the radical left who can shift the common sense of the public further in the direction that we need it to in terms of fighting inequality and distributing wealth in a way which benefits everybody. Another great thinker, because I'm just going to name drop people who I think you should listen to, read. Antonio Gramsci, epic guy, came up with the idea of hegemony, which is that people can be controlled through this kind of common sense, through the idea that this is the way the world is meant to be, through ideology. And by changing hegemony, changing the way that people think en masse, it makes it far easier for collective movements to grow and expand and eventually become accepted as the new normal. So yeah, that's problem number one. and also the sort of solution. Problem number two is austerity. I've touched on this. It's about how degrowth can be portrayed as people taking away what you have, further cuts on what you have, further tax rises, you able to buy less. And so it will be a difficult transition, but degrowth as a movement will have to fight really hard against that image and work on ways to convince people that it is not austerity. It is about working out how we can make people happiest and how we can move beyond the traditional ways of thinking about money and into questions of, what is the best way to live?
I have no further comments other than that sounds like a good idea.
Fantastic. Okay, well, that's all I have to say. Do you have any questions on the broader topic as a whole?
Well, I just want to say, like, thank you for coming on. I mentioned before how you've sort of brought a lot of ideas that I've heard in different places under this one bigger idea. But I think what's been especially useful about this is clearing up that question of austerity, is that initially my reaction to degrowth was like, it sounds interesting, but I'm kind of worried about, like, taking away all my material possessions. But it's not that. It is more of a rational focus on increasing happiness and respecting the planet's boundaries and decreasing inequality, which is, it all sounds a lot more reasonable than just, you know, get rid of everything because that's in danger. And so I want to thank you for that and for coming on. I don't really have any questions at the present. My mind is all in a bottle trying to like reconcile these things. It's been a really interesting conversation. And I'll take a while to think about it, but it seems really interesting. And I think I am probably on your side as well in this debate. So thank you for coming on.
Thank you. I've had a whale of a time. Loads of fun. I really do hope that you probably consider these ideas and consider working them into your podcast in the future. I think what you're doing here is great. Keep spreading the ideas of degrowth. I think it's like my main message today is that it's really important to challenge eco-modernism in all its forms. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for coming on, and we'll see you in the next episode.